Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org.
I'm David Gura, sitting in for Jen White. You're listening to the News Roundup.
Anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
That was President Biden speaking to the nation from the East Room in the White House last night. Scores are dead after two explosions rocked Kabul's airport on Thursday. That number includes at least 13 U.S. service members. It's the deadliest single-day U.S. casualty event in Afghanistan in a decade. So with 4 days left to leave the country, what happens now? Anita Kumar is a White House correspondent for Politico, where she's also an associate editor. Anita, always a pleasure.
Great to be back.
And Alexis Immendinger is a national correspondent for The Hill. Hey, Alexis, welcome back to 1A.
Hey, good to hear you.
Alexis, let me start with you. The actual death toll of the bombing still unclear. Some local estimates say at least 13 are dead. Others put that number at 40, 70, even 110. Here's journalist Matthew Akins of The New York Times. He was reporting at the scene on that airport road near the Abbey Gate and Barron Hotel.
I talked to someone who was there. He said he was about 10 meters away. He was in this huge press of people that were just cramming up, desperate to show their documents to these Marines who were standing there. And he said he was about 10 meters, 20, 30 feet away from the Marines. And in the crush of people, he kind of tripped and lost his footing. And then there was this blast and total chaos. People were on the ground. The Marines were shooting. People were running over bodies. It was just blood everywhere. His cousin was a little bit was wounded. You know, he thinks, the guy told me that he thought at least four or five Marines were killed on the spot.
Matthew Akins of The New York Times. Alexis, at this point, what do we know about what happened with these bombings? We understand that the White House, the administration, had been warned that the situation was getting increasingly difficult and there was a likelihood that something could happen.
That's right. The U.S. government, through intelligence, felt that there was a real present risk and had warned Americans not to go to the airport to try to stay away. And what did happen was that they didn't have enough intelligence to actually describe or know exactly what would be happening, but they certainly were very clear about the vulnerability at the Kabul airport. There were two suicide bombings. They were in close proximity to the Abbey Gate. One was also at a nearby hotel. And the blasts were so large that, of course, the carnage was just shocking and horrifying. And also the smoke and the destruction could be seen, you know, from a far distance. So immediately the U.S. military and the government began to, you know, try to pull together as much information as possible. But one of the things that I thought was so compelling about yesterday's briefings was not only the anticipation that this might happen, but also the expectation that this will happen again, potentially before Tuesday, and that Tuesday's final deadline to actually extract the remaining 5,000 or so U.S. service members will be a harrowing, harrowing experience to actually pull up, remove them, while these huge crowds of Afghans and others are still trying to flee.
Anita Kumar, on that point, I'll turn to you. What has the administration said about how what happened on that airport road affects their progress toward that deadline, which Alexis mentioned is just a few days away from today?
Well, they say that they're going to continue with this August 31st deadline. But I do think that privately and maybe even publicly, they're saying, look, this has given them new resolve. Look, there are Americans and others in danger if this continues, if the United States stays in Afghanistan. This is what the president says he has always feared. And this is giving them sort of another reason to say, look, we've got to stick with this August 31st deadline. As you know, Democrats and Republicans are both saying, look, we can't stay with that deadline. We are going to leave perhaps Americans and other vulnerable Afghans there if we leave on August 31st. And they are asking the president to delay that. And it does not sound like, you know, he is going to do that. He has been very clear that he thinks that August 31st is the day. And this is just another reason that America and the United States and the troops are vulnerable if the United States continues to stay.
Anita, you've been tracking this. These attacks happened. What did that do to the progress that was being made? Did these flights continue? Did the operation to evacuate Americans and Afghans out of the country continue after these attacks took place apace?
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is going to impact that, and this has impacted that. But what the White House is saying is, look, we're going to resume these flights and we're going to get people out that we can by the deadline. But, you know, you did see a shift in what the White House was saying, a subtle one, but a shift that they had basically said before the attacks, we will be getting everyone out. We will be getting all Americans out. And what we heard from the president was, we are going to do our best. We are going to get most of those people out. But he really did leave open the door that, you know, perhaps people will be left behind. And you see a lot of members of Congress and others really seizing on that and saying, look, we can't be leaving people behind there. We can't be leaving Americans and others who want to get out. And so I think you're going to see this, you know, very subtle shift in language in these coming days as we reach that deadline on Tuesday.
Alexis, I want to ask you about language in a sec, but I'm going to read a tweet here from AC Monroe tweeting at us at 1A. I'm glad the Biden administration is sticking with the withdrawal date. The suicide bomb attack is exactly why we must get all our troops out of Afghanistan. American troops should not be occupying a sovereign country. The longer our troops are there, the more danger they're in. And that's certainly something we heard in the remarks from the president last night. Alexis, President Biden has promised retribution, and I wonder how the administration is defining that term. David Ignatius, in his column in The Washington Post today, said that sounded like a presidential directive to the CIA's drone operators. On this issue of language, what does it mean? What understanding do we have of what retribution looks like in light of these attacks yesterday?
Well, President Biden was also, I think, signaling that his experience with the United States going after terrorists is a long and patient process. So he certainly did not put a timeline or a description on it, and he described at the time and method of our choosing. And so that was to signal to, obviously the administration believes this was an ISIS-K operation, and signaling what military might is available to try to track them down and get them. And, of course, drone strikes is one option the United States has used effectively in the past. But in no way was the president trying to signal when this would occur. And, of course, the United States will be working as much as possible with allied nations with their intelligence as well.
Talk with Alexis Simmendinger of The Hill, Anita Kumar of Politico as well. Anita, let me ask you about the term Alexis just used there, ISIS-K, Islamic State of Khorasan. What do we know about the group? The president called it an arch enemy of the Taliban. It has an uneasy, shall we say, relationship with the Taliban now in control of that country.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a lot of Americans may not be familiar with it. It's sort of an Afghan offshoot of the Islamic State, which Americans might remember several years ago. Claimed responsibility or deemed responsible for beheading journalists, and obviously have been involved in brutalities in Iraq and Syria. But you're right. This is not. There are a lot of people that are sort of looking at this and saying, "Oh, this is the Taliban." Actually, it's not. And as you indicated, and the president indicated, they are groups that do not get along. So this isn't the Taliban that's responsible. But there's just more indication of the utter chaos that's going on in this country, where different things are happening, different groups are involved. And so I think we're going to be hearing more about them just because of what the president has said, that there will be some retribution, even though we don't know when that's going to be.
Alexis, I know you're lending an ear to what's being said on Capitol Hill broadly, since we're on recess now. But you did have two House members, Republican Peter Meyer and Democrat Seth Moulton, making a trip to Afghanistan this week, a trip that was roundly criticized by leadership of their parties, by the defense secretary through his spokesman, and by the White House as well. What happened? What was the objective of the trip, and sort of what's the result of them making that journey to Kabul and back?
This was about 48 hours ago now or so, and the two members of Congress who are both wartime veterans felt that it was important for them to do what they called oversight of the executive branch. And on their own, they made a trip to Afghanistan without in any way preparing with the U.S. military, so this was a surprise. Their visit, they have said in subsequent interviews, was very informative to them, that they ended up actually changing their minds about whether the United States should leave by the deadline, August 31. They felt that their trip explained to them and showed them as much as possible in the hours that they were there in the airport that it was important to end this and wrap this up on August 31. But the amount of blowback that they sustained once it was known that they had made this undisclosed secret trip was intense, and Speaker Pelosi definitely boxed them in public about what they had done, warned other members of Congress, don't do this, that this was a terrible miscarriage of their judgment about this. And then, interestingly, in her reaction to the suicide bombings yesterday, her statement initially went back at this question about whether other members of the House would think about traveling there, and she definitely warned them, do not do this.
You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll be back with more of the week's biggest headlines after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're rounding up the week's biggest headlines, and let's bring in one more voice now as we turn our attention to the pandemic. Julie Rovner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hey there, Julie.
Hi, David.
Well, let's start with COVID, as I say, and a wave of vaccine mandates has begun to wash over many parts of America, at least, as the FDA officially approved Pfizer's COVID vaccine earlier this week. We're seeing it at universities, hospitals, even the Pentagon has said it'll begin to require employees to either get vaccinated or be tested once or twice a week. So let's start with this is a sea change moment, the approval that we saw from the FDA this week.
Yeah, I think it's a tipping point more for employers, as you say, than for actual people. One of the last polls showed about 30% of the vaccine hesitant said that they would be more likely to get the vaccine if it's fully approved by the FDA. But we're starting to see that some of those people are now coming up with other reasons they might not want to get vaccinated. On the other hand, employers who were able to mandate the vaccine even while it was operating under an emergency use authorization are feeling more comfortable with a mandate now that at least the Pfizer vaccine has been fully licensed. And I think that's why we saw that the sort of quick action by many large employers, both public and private, to say, yeah, you really do need to get this vaccine unless you have a legitimate medical or religious reason not to, or you're willing to be tested frequently.
We're talking about this in a business context, Julie, and let me ask you how real the concerns are about there being staffing shortages. As you said just a moment ago, we still see pushback. There are those who have said, hospital workers, firefighters, others who have said that they plan to protest the mandates. They've threatened to quit. There could be some economic ramifications to this, couldn't there be?
It is a real concern. And, you know, there are still labor shortages in lots of areas around the country. And there is some concern that people would quit rather than get the vaccine. It's a concern in places like nursing homes, where it's always been hard to get staff and where a lot of that staff has been reluctant to get vaccinated. Of course, they were offered the vaccine in the very first wave. So they really were sort of the very first people to be offered it. Now that it's, you know, that we've seen hundreds of millions of people get the vaccine with very few ill effects, one would think that they would be more likely to go ahead and do that. But it is a continuing concern about people, you know, opting, you know, not to work rather than get vaccinated.
Anita Kumar, Julie Rovner detailing how this changes the calculus for businesses. How about for the Biden White House and its approach to those who have been, shall we say, reticent to get the vaccine? How does it change their messaging, having this approval from the FDA?
Well, of course, they welcome it. You know, this is something that they've been urging people to do, and they've been frustrated that people are not getting vaccinated. And as Julie said, this is one of the reasons that people gave, that they said, look, we don't want to do this until it gets full approval. So they are hoping that this really does push employers. What's really been interesting is to watch the White House really shift its language. Again, we're talking about shifting language on mandates. They had not, they were reticent at first about these mandates. And now you see after this FDA approval that they're saying, and the president's saying, employers, let's mandate this. You know, you now can mandate this, and let's go ahead and do that. And so they're hoping a lot of employers follow suit. Of course, they hope that there's some approval for the other vaccines as well down the road.
Julie, I want to ask you about Delta Airlines' approach to this. Delta, uneasy to use the term Delta variant, the CEO of the company referring to the B16172 variant instead. That's the Delta variant, as we call it. In a memo to his staff, some 60,000 employees, Ed Bastian said he was pleased that 75% of that workforce has been vaccinated. But he detailed what will become of those on staff who have not gotten the vaccine. Walk us through that. There is an insurance penalty the CEO plans to put in place.
That's right. Delta has decided, rather than mandate the vaccine, to say, okay, go ahead, don't be vaccinated. But if you choose not to be vaccinated, starting in November, you're going to pay a $200 a month increase in your health insurance premiums. Now, people running around saying, no, they can't do that. That's what the Affordable Care Act did. That's not quite right. The Affordable Care Act said that insurers could not charge higher premiums based on people's pre-existing conditions or their health status. But employers, under the guise of wellness benefits, can say, if you choose not to take this wellness benefit and they consider the vaccine part of wellness, then we can charge you more. So it's pretty clear that it's legal for them to do it. There's a lot of question. People are worried about slippery slopes, whether employers will start to penalize other what are considered risky behaviors. They are one of the few large organizations that has done this so far. So I think it'll be sort of a natural experiment whether they get better compliance than someone, another airline like United, which is just mandating the vaccine for its workers.
And I'll quote from the Delta CEO's memo here. The surcharge will be necessary to address the financial risk the decision to not vaccinate is creating for our company. Ed Bastian saying the average hospital stay for COVID-19 has cost Delta $50,000. Per person. Alexis Simdinger, I want to ask you about this report that was finalized this week. The White House said there's 90 days to figure out the origins of the COVID-19 virus. I gather there is a confidential version of that report that's been completed. The White House has indicated we'll get a more public-facing version this week. What do we know of what's in that intelligence report on the origins of the virus?
Well, I think the bottom line is that the best efforts to try to take 90 days to run this to ground still came up splint and undecided about the origins, and it, to some extent also somewhat pessimistic that it's possible to actually know the origins of COVID-19 without, as long as time is going by and without the full cooperation of the Chinese government, which of course is not anticipated. So as time is going by, as scientists are examining this, there is still a split about whether the origin of COVID-19 came naturally in a leap from, say, bats or other animals to humans, or whether it actually leaked out of a virology laboratory in Wuhan, China, or some other manner like that, and then entered the human population and then spread human to human. So it is possible, according to scientists, that we are unlikely to actually know what the answer is, and whatever the declassified report is that comes out is likely to emphasize those basic takeaways.
Julie Rovner, I want you to weigh in on this as well, Alexis, detailing the fact that the more time passes, the more difficult this becomes, and then also just the resistance or difficulty we've had getting international cooperation from China. Are you as pessimistic as you gaze into your crystal ball and try to foresee whether or not we will have a true origin story of this virus?
Yeah, and it's frustrating because it's the source of a lot of misinformation. It would be helpful to know what the origin story is, but at this point, it's a little bit late in the game for that to make a really big difference beyond the fact that if it did somehow come from a lab, we would want to make sure that it didn't ever happen again.
Julie, some news about boosters this week as well from Pfizer and Moderna. This week, Johnson & Johnson announced that a second dose of its shot would give recipients stronger protection against the virus. Talk a bit, if you would, just about that research and where that vaccine in particular is in this process of becoming more widely used and more widely recommended for those who got that version of the shot.
Yeah, this has been sort of a difficult messaging measure for public health officials. At this point, what they're pretty comfortable with is saying that for people who are immunocompromised, who are cancer patients or organ transplant patients, for some reason that their initial vaccines didn't take, an additional shot, and they're not calling it a booster, they're just calling it a third dose, is very useful. There's still a bit of a debate about boosters for everybody else, about whether your actual resistance is declining, and if it happens in 6 months or in 8 months, it's obviously the FDA and the CDC would need to weigh in on boosters, and they haven't done that yet, although they're looking at it. It's certainly expected that there will be a need for boosters, and the federal government is planning for that, but the science is still not quite settled on how boosters are going to work.
You look at a map of this country at the incidence of the coronavirus, your eyes are drawn to Texas and to Florida as well. In Texas this week, the National Rifle Association decided to cancel its annual meeting in Houston for the second year in a row. In a statement, the NRA said, quote, "We are mindful that NRA annual meeting patrons will return home to family, friends, and coworkers from all over the country, so any impacts from this virus could have broader implications." Alexis, I'll turn to you on this. Texas Governor Greg Abbott still convalescing. He tested positive for COVID-19. What does this decision mean politically, just looking at Texas as a sort of political crucible for what's been going on with how different states have approached this virus?
Well, there is absolutely no question that Texas is a troubled state when it comes to COVID-19, and also troubled politically because of the vigorous debate that Governor Abbott has helped to fuel about mandates. So what we're watching this week is a state that is talking about this huge surge, this fourth wave of COVID-19 infections, perhaps as much as 50% of their hospital beds are filled with COVID-19 patients, and the governor has actually recruited out-of-state healthcare workers and dispatched them around his state to try to ease some of the pressure on the hospitals and the healthcare staff because of the huge surge of patients. But at the same time, of course, there's an awareness of organizations and the governor that these infections can spread beyond the state. Obviously, the National Rifle Association made a decision based on its membership. And then at the same time, the governor is talking about how this week issuing another order in which he did not want any district in his state to be able to issue a mandate for vaccines. And of course, he has argued that all the way into court over mask mandates. So Texas is a real conundrum, and it's obviously a hot stew of political debate over COVID-19.
A real conundrum. Anita Kumar, to what degree is the White House throwing its hands in the air as a result of this? I mean, it's trying to mount a national strategy here for combating the virus, and yet you have places like Florida and Texas, which are going not only their own way, but you have the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, who is saying his way is, despite all of this, despite the incredibly high numbers we're seeing, working compared to what the Biden administration is trying to do. What is the White House's strategy here amidst what we're seeing in all of these states?
Yeah, I mean, you saw Governor DeSantis in Florida not only saying it's working, but he's saying President Biden should follow his lead. I can tell you the White House is not going to follow the lead of Texas or Florida. You know, they are frustrated by this. They're getting questions all the time about how they have a national strategy when there are states like Florida and Texas, not the only, but of course, the hot spots right now. You know, pushing back on this. And this has been an issue for this administration. It's been an issue for the Trump administration or the Trump White House, where this is one of the biggest problems with COVID is that you know, the states get to make some of these decisions. Localities get to make some of these decisions. And the White House cannot mandate everything. That's just not the system of government we have in the United States. And so it's a frustration for them. You've seen the president, when he's asked about it, sort of throw up his hands, as you said, and say, what governor, when he was asked about, I believe it was Ron DeSantis. You know, it's frustrating for them. They are continuing on with the same strategy they've had, which is they believe that if they get influential people, and those influential people they believe are sort of local folks, people in your community, pastors or local organizers, to talk about getting the vaccine and talk about good strategies, then that will help. They're also trying to get influencers in for young people, other people that you might respect and listen to, and kind of just working around them. I mean, there's really nothing else they can do. They are continuing on the strategy, and the strategy continues to be everyone should get vaccinated.
And the guy with the sign. Julie, let me ask you about Florida here. 75 Florida doctors participating in a symbolic walkout this week to protest the number of unvaccinated people in the state of Florida. Here's one of them. Let's take a listen.
They come in faster than what you can move. And it's very, very taxing on all the healthcare providers. It's tiring. We're all tired. We've been doing this since the beginning of July, and it doesn't seem to want to stop.
Pandemic currently at its worst point in Florida, Julie, an average of about 227 deaths per day. A lot of people wondering what's going on. What's the cause of this? Is it that low vaccination rate? Is it a lack of masking? A combination of that? What explains what we're seeing in Florida today?
Well, certainly the governor has, you know, tried to make sure that everything is open and that mask mandates are not allowed. And we have this much more contagious Delta variant. I mean, this is almost the opposite of where we were last year at this time. We have a much more contagious disease and people taking many fewer precautions. And that's why you're seeing so many cases. You know, we are seeing obviously some breakthrough cases of people who are fully vaccinated, although those are generally not the people who are ending up in the hospital. Those are basically the unvaccinated people. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, health workers are not okay. Many of them have been working, you know, almost nonstop for a year and a half now. I mean, we've had a couple of, you know, quiet months, you know, one or two here and there between waves. But health workers are really frustrated that people who are coming in now who could have been fully vaccinated by now. And I think it's important to mention that that walkout was not a walkout. Those were doctors who were not actually on duty at the time they had that press conference.
Duly noted. Julie, a question about ivermectin. Amidst the madness of misinformation, this is a medicine that's commonly used to treat worms in horses. It has been bandied about as something that could be used to treat COVID-19. In fact, it does not do that, and has been having deleterious effects on people who have taken it. Walk us through the consequences of this as another sort of quack treatment that's resulting in really serious injury to people who have taken it.
Yes, people are going to, you know, livestock supply stores and getting horse wormer and cow wormer to prevent or treat COVID. And ivermectin is not for that, and it can be dangerous in those formulations. There are some human formulations for ivermectin. There are a couple of things that people do take it for, but please don't take horse drugs or dog drugs to treat or prevent COVID. It doesn't work.
Heed the advice there. One of our listeners on Twitter writing, regarding vaccine mandates and the slippery slope, the company I work for has been charging a surcharge for at least 5 years for smokers. If we don't get biometric screening done every fall during open enrollment, we are subject to paying more for our health insurance. More from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from Capital One. With the Capital One Venture Card, you earn unlimited double miles on every purchase every day. And you can use those miles toward travel expenses like flights, hotels, rental cars, and more. Just book and pay for your travel using your Venture Card and redeem your miles toward the cost. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USANA. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
Let's get back to the news roundup. On Tuesday, House Democrats narrowly passed a budget plan totaling $3.5 trillion.
A national budget should be a statement of our national values. What is important to us as a nation should be reflected in our budget. And this will be the case.
That new budget, major step toward expanding social safety net programs and enacting some of the Democrats' biggest priorities. We will get into the sequencing of this in Capitol Hill speak in just a moment. But Alexis Simendinger, I'll start with you. Tell us about what's in here. What comprises this $3.5 trillion bill?
Well, I think, David, it's a good thing to start with what isn't in there, actually. But there is so much in the this effort to fill in all of the blanks here now that they have approved the sort of framework of this. But the general discussion has been everything from support for children and child care to seniors who need housing assistance to health care to efforts to put in ingredients for immigration, all kinds of climate support programs to battle climate change. So it's just a whopper of a presentation. And of course, we're in for just one of the more rollicking fall legislative periods of time that I can remember in the Capitol, because the margins of error for the Democrats who hold the majorities in the House and the Senate are so small. In the House, it's just 3. And we watched Speaker Pelosi really struggle with her own party, the moderates in her party, against the progressives. And that will continue, because that $3.5 trillion that you mentioned may have lots in it to recommend it to many, many Democrats, but not all Democrats in the House caucus, Democratic caucus, believe it should be that big. And so we're going to see some real interesting fights that continue into the fall over just that part of it. And then we have infrastructure and other elements that I'm sure you're going to mention.
Yeah, sure to be rollicking. Brief as well, because the deadline's on this. And Julie Rovner, let me ask you about what's in it when it comes to health care and to medicine. Walk us through what's in this $3.5 trillion bill that has to do with health care.
Well, it's important to remember that there is no $3.5 trillion bill yet. What they passed was the budget resolution.
Legislative instrument.
Right. What sets in motion the orders to write the $3.5 trillion bill. So that's where the number comes from. Now comes the actual drafting of this. On health care, there's some pretty big things that Congress intends to do. Expand benefits for the Medicare program, probably not lower the eligibility age. That would engender so much opposition from the healthcare industry that they probably are not going to go there, but they are planning to do things like add dental coverage and vision coverage to Medicare. They want to make permanent some of these improvements to the Affordable Care Act subsidies that were put in the last big spending bill that was done at the beginning of this year. And they want to make sure that Medicaid is available to the couple of million people in the 12 states that have yet to expand it under the Affordable Care Act. So together, those would be some big changes to the healthcare system, and they would be expensive. And to pay for it, they want to do something about prescription drug prices, which is going to be its own fight.
A lot of fighting happening on Capitol Hill here in the coming weeks. So, Anita Kumar, I want to go back to that number that Alexis mentioned a moment ago, 220 to 212 in terms of getting this passed in the House. Given that, how big a victory was this? And give us your perspective on the difficulty that the House Speaker faces, yes, with her members, keeping them in line as this process proceeds.
Well, no doubt it was a victory, because for a few days, and I know we've been saying this for months, it didn't look like it was going anywhere. You know, it was threatened. We were thinking that it might fall apart. So the fact that they moved one step forward is a victory, both for the House Speaker and, of course, for the President, because this is a major part of his priorities and his agenda. The Speaker is really credited with bringing those two sides of her party together to get this. But as we've just talked about, this is just one step. Really, the hard part here is going to be coming up with what this bill is really going to have. You know, we have these moderate members of the House saying, look, we don't want to approve something that's not going to get through the Senate, right? The 50-50 Senate, where we've seen senators like Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of Arizona saying that they are not going to want to go for something this big. So really the hard part comes now What is the scope of this? How big is it going to be? And what's going to be in it? And that's where we're going to have to see the House Speaker really try to negotiate these two factions of her party. And we've seen sort of some of them talking after this was over, both claiming credit, saying they won. Really, it did sound like a compromise because there are two things that are going to be happening within, you know, this fall, both this package we're talking about and this infrastructure deal, this smaller, more traditional infrastructure package. And that's really always been the issue. Which is going to come first? Are they going to go together? And so I would say it's a victory, for the president who didn't think it, you know, who was worried watching the House. But still, they have a long way to go.
Here we are talking about sequencing. And Alexis, I wonder if you could share a bit about what the conversation must be like or must have been like between, you know, fewer than a dozen centrist Democrats and the House Speaker. Correct me if I'm wrong here. I gather it had to do with how that infrastructure package would be prioritized.
That's right. This has to do with leverage. In the case of the progressives, the liberals in the House, their feeling all along has been that the reconciliation package, the budget package that you just described with this giant $3.5 trillion price tag, it is so filled with Democratic initiatives that they favor. They wanted the leverage of marrying it, linking it to the bipartisan infrastructure measure that was basically put together in the Senate, because they're not as thrilled with that. That was a modification and really a ramping down of ambitions. But so progressives want these two things to be married. Moderate Democrats were arguing to Speaker Pelosi, look, we've got this bipartisan infrastructure bill that is hugely popular in the United States, would help right away, is ready to pass. The Senate passed it. Let's go first with infrastructure, and we can show we can really get things done. And it would be hugely influential in my district, by the way, in my midterm election. So Speaker Pelosi had to figure out how to navigate this sequencing issue that has to do with political leverage in order to not lose some ingredients. And so the modification she agreed to, Anita's right that it was a triumph for her because she got all Democrats to vote, just at least in general for the framework. But what she gave up a little bit is this concession that they have to come back in mid-September and get ready to vote on infrastructure in the House on September, or at least by September 27th. So what the moderates got out of it was a date certain when they will actually get a vote. And that potentially looks like it could occur before this big reconciliation measure that Anita described and Julie knows takes forever to write. And they're trying to do that right now.
Another piece of legislative action I want to note. This week, the House also passed the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. That legislation aimed at combating the wave of restrictive voting laws in Republican states now heads to the Senate, where it's expected to face some serious opposition from the GOP. And the House Select Committee responsible for investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection is expanding its probe. New requests include communications by former President Donald Trump and his top officials. Alexis, I'll turn to you on this. What request is this select committee making here, again, during recess, with a pretty short timeline? I think they want a lot of this information within a period of about 2 weeks.
Right. This is a select committee, of course, that's being driven primarily by Democrats in the House, with a few Republicans thrown in who are eager to join in the investigation. The spectrum of things that they want is very, very broad, and so they have issued requests for information to a huge fan of cabinet departments and offices. They have issued requests to the National Archives to get communications that former President Trump has already signaled that he might argue is executive privilege. They want to really look into communications that involve the White House discussions leading up to January 6th and after. So they may have a tight time frame, but they have this enormous spectrum of information that they're asking for. They have subpoena power, but as we know from the past in Washington, when you're dealing with an oversight committee like this, there are all kinds of foot-dragging techniques and going to court and arguing over executive privilege. And so this may be an effort that has to get whittled down to sort of its essence in terms of what they want and need.
Anita, from your vantage, how significant is this expansion of this probe by the Select Committee?
Well, it's significant. I mean, we had heard that they were going to do things like this, that, you know, the chairman has said, look, we're going to look in everything. So as Alexis mentioned, they're looking at what happened before that day, what happened on that day, you know, what the security is like. You know, probably the most significant point, though, or piece that they're looking at is really what President Trump's, you know, participation was. You know, what did he say and what did he, who did he talk to? Other interesting point is he's also, they're also looking at which members of Congress he talked to. What did he say to them? And so you have Republicans saying, look, this is partisan. It's mostly Democrats looking at this, and they want to know about Republicans and Republican lawmakers. They're going after the former president and Republican members of Congress. So it's significant, but as Alexis said, oh, we've seen this so many times where there is, this just drags on. They're not going to get what they want in 2 weeks. They may have to subpoena. They may have to go to court. It'll go on for a while, but I think it just signals to us that how serious and how expansive this investigation is going to be.
So that's what's going on Capitol Hill related to January 6th, just a few blocks away, Federal District Court in the District of Columbia, something new on the docket, a suit from seven U.S. Capitol police officers against a variety of individuals and groups, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Roger Stone is mentioned as well. Alexis, what's going on with this lawsuit? What's being alleged in that lawsuit, and how could that affect sort of what we learn about what happened on January the 6th?
Well, the basic lawsuit involves seven Capitol Police, and their argument in the filing is that former President Trump and other officials were in a large measure responsible for ginning up and basically dialing up the heat of what turned out to be the insurrection or the attack on the Capitol, which obviously cost lives and major injuries, and then subsequent, very sadly, the suicides of Capitol Police. Separate and apart from their lawsuit trying to describe fault or place blame for the damage that they feel that they suffered, we also saw a very interesting interview this week where one of the Capitol Police, who actually fired his weapon and shot Ashley Babbitt, who died, one of the rioters, Michael Byrd, gave an interview and really came forward in public, and he described a kind of a range of suffering that he has felt since the death of Ashley Babbitt and his experience with the riot, and he described the kind of mental anguish or the threats that he's received. And of course, he was exonerated for that shooting. He is not suffering any penalty for his job or under the law.
A threat, including one from the former president, who has mentioned him, if not by name, by who he is in statements he's issued in recent days. I'll turn lastly here to the Supreme Court, which has reinstated the Remain in Mexico program. Missouri and Texas had sued. This was a Trump-era policy that requires migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. to wait in Mexico pending the assessment of their applications. And Anita, I wonder if you could just remind us what this program is and sort of what the Biden administration has said its plan is for the program, what it wants to see going forward.
Yeah, this whole thing is just continues the mess of the immigration system and what's been happening these last few years. This is something President Trump's administration put into place, and it was basically requiring tens of thousands of people to wait in Mexico while seeking asylum in the United States. It was something that Mexico didn't want, but sort of went along with. I mean, it was really meant to discourage asylum seekers from coming to the United States or trying to come. But of course, critics said it was, you know, denying people the legal right to seek the protection, forcing them to wait in dangerous places in Mexico. So what the Supreme Court has said is that the process of getting rid of this program likely violated federal law. And what they're saying is, you can come back and try again. And so the administration is probably going to come back and try again. They're going to say that here's another way we can get rid of it, you know, get rid of this policy. In the meantime, though, they are going to have to comply with what the Supreme Court said while they appeal, while they try to get rid of it again. And so we don't really know what's going to happen. You know, Mexico hasn't really said what they're going to do. You have a lot of advocates telling Mexico, please don't agree to this. Don't let the United States do this. And we don't really know. I will say that over top of this whole situation is that the Biden administration has kept in place a Trump policy that really essentially closes the border anyway. So this point is a little bit moot. I mean, it's not as severe as you might think, because the Biden administration has said because of COVID that they should not be having asylum seekers come to the United States anyway, that they everybody needs to wait because it could be a health problem. So it just continues this sort of mess of what's been going on with these two presidents trying to figure out what they want to do.
That's Anita Kumar. She's a White House correspondent at Politico, where she's also an associate editor. Alexis Simmendinger is a national correspondent for The Hill. Julie Rovner, the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. My thanks to all of you. One A's interim audio engineer and sound designer is Mike Kidd. He gets technical assistance from Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Chris Cristano is our digital editor. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
We're rounding up the week's biggest headlines from around the globe. It's the international edition of the News Roundup. Evacuations continue in Afghanistan after a deadly attack at the Kabul airport killed dozens of people, including at least 13 U.S. service members. The Pentagon now says there was one suicide bombing, not two. They blamed chaos on the ground for the initial confusion. An ISIS splinter group is taking responsibility for that attack, and President Joe Biden says there will be consequences.
Anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Meanwhile, COVID-19 rages in Israel, and an investigation into the origins of the coronavirus comes up inconclusive. Joining us from Washington to talk about the latest international news is Jennifer Williams. She is the former senior foreign editor at Vox and the soon-to-be deputy editor at Foreign Policy. Welcome back to the show, Jen. Congratulations on the new job as well.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Laura Seligman also joins us from Washington. She covers the Pentagon for Politico. Great to have you back, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And David Rennie is the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. He joins us today from the Chinese capital. Hello again, David.
Hello.
Laura, let me start with you and that clip that we just played of the president at the top of the show, speaking in the East Room of the White House yesterday. Strong words from the president, a little reminiscent perhaps of what President George W. Bush said at the beginning of this conflict. He said that his intention was to, quote, smoke them out of their holes back then, now 20 years ago. What do we know of the administration's strategy going forward, as complicated perhaps by what happened yesterday?
Well, certainly the president made clear yesterday that we are still going to be continuing the evacuation mission. We are still leaving Afghanistan by August 31st. So that part is going to stay the same. But now what has complicated this is that we are likely, as he said, we're going to hunt down and we're going to find and hunt down the people responsible for these bombings. And now it's ISIS-K, of course, as you said, which is a splinter group of ISIS in Afghanistan that we're going to have to figure out where they've been based in Afghanistan. That's a big question here. Did they operate from cells underground in Kabul? If so, it's going to be very difficult to smoke them out and to get revenge that way, because there are so many civilians, American citizens, and Afghan allies still in Kabul that we need to evacuate. And of course, the issue here is that this demonstrates the ability of ISIS-K to actually continue conducting terrorist activities, at least within Afghanistan. Now, this was something that President Biden has said was not really a threat from Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda, not just ISIS-K, but also Al-Qaeda, he said last week in an address, I believe, that they were no longer a threat in Afghanistan. Now, this obviously shows that they still are a threat to Afghanistan, to U.S. citizens and U.S. troops in Afghanistan. So the big question now is, how do we fight back? How do we make sure that ISIS is not going to pose a threat from Afghanistan? Because obviously the Taliban is not really doing their job of keeping these terrorists at bay, of providing security to the airport. It's clearly not a good situation there right now, and it really does change the whole counterterrorism calculus going forwards.
Jennifer, there is such delicacy here. As the Taliban tries to establish some form of government here in just the days after they overtook Afghanistan, and picking up on what Laura said there, how are they interpreting what happened on that road to the airport? What does it say to them about the difficulty of continuing to hold control of this country? There were indications that because of how packed that airport road was, there were indications that there could be an attack like this. This was a very real threat, and as Laura was saying, it indicates that we could see more attacks like this in the future.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I would say that this isn't exactly a surprise for the Taliban, right? They have been fighting ISIS-K for quite a while now inside Afghanistan. They are enemies. ISIS-K in particular was formed from people who included militants who were disaffected from the Afghan Taliban, as well as the Pakistani Taliban and other groups. But they essentially feel like the Taliban is gone soft, right? That they're not extreme enough. And you can see, you know, the fact that the Taliban is in many cases working with the U.S. In Kabul right now to organize security and to, you know, take care of these evacuations and to establish, you know, security perimeter, et cetera. So that alone, shows to the people who are attracted to ISIS-K that, see, the Taliban has gone soft. This is why we need to be more extreme. We need to keep fighting. We need to kick out these Americans, et cetera. And so, you know, the Taliban has been dealing with this for a long time. That said, you know, they are now trying to hold vast amounts of territory in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a huge country, and Kabul alone is an incredibly complicated security situation. They are providing this kind of security perimeter around the airport. Mm. But, you know, we heard from General McKenzie yesterday talking about, you know, the operational abilities of the Taliban. You know, in some checkpoints, areas, you may have Taliban fighters, militants who are actually capable of providing a secure security cordon and actually stopping people from coming through. But in other cases, you may have fighters who are not very good, who are not very well trained. It's kind of a mixed bag. And so the U.S. is kind of trying to rely on the Taliban, which is just, that alone is an astonishing turn of events, right? That the U.S. and the Taliban are working together to provide security. And so, you know, it's a really difficult situation for the U.S. to have to essentially rely on the Taliban to stop people from getting past that kind of first outer layer of security. But then once they do, they're all kind of crammed up against this smaller perimeter that the U.S. is manning and trying to pat down each individual person and kind of let them come through the gate. And that's what happened when we saw this terror attack, the suicide bombing, you know, right up close with large group of people, including, you know, several, you know, many U.S. Forces on the ground. And so, you know, the Taliban is trying right now to figure out how to provide security in Kabul, as well as for the rest of the country, and work with the Americans and form a government and it's very difficult.
Strange Bedfellows doesn't do it justice. And Laura Seligman, I want to turn to the piece that you wrote with Andrew Desiderio and Alex Ward, your colleagues at Politico, looking at the degree to which the United States has cooperated with the Taliban to get, yes, American citizens, but also Afghans out of the country in this very compressed deadline. You reported on a list that was shared by the U.S. with the Taliban, and it was something the president was asked about yesterday in his press conference as well. Speak to that, if you would, the strangeness, the difficulty of the United States working with its enemy in this moment of crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we've discussed before, we did know that the U.S. was coordinating with the Taliban on the ground in Kabul. But what we didn't know was that U.S. officials have been providing the Taliban lists of specific names of people to let into the airport. And this includes not only American citizens, green card holders, but Afghan interpreters and other allies that are seeking special immigrant visas to come to the United States. Now, the problem, of course, is that the Taliban has this long history of hunting down and brutally murdering Afghans, specifically the ones that have been helping American forces during the conflict. I mean, we've heard many anecdotes from interpreters who've had family members killed and their houses burned down by the Taliban specifically for that involvement. So it really speaks to the difficulty that we're having coordinating with the Taliban and the reliance that we have on the Taliban for security at the airport and for many, many other things around Kabul. Now, it's important to say that the Biden administration, behind the scenes, they did defend this move to provide the list of names, saying it was designed to speed the evacuation because, of course, like I said, the Taliban are the ones who are manning all the checkpoints to get into the airport, and it was supposed to speed things up. But lawmakers and military officials, as we reported, are just furious that this is happening. One defense official said it basically amounts to a kill list. And I think there are many lawmakers that agree. It came up during a classified briefing on Capitol Hill earlier this week, which we reported. And that briefing turned very contentious. In fact, several lawmakers have already come out since we published the story calling for investigations. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the president himself, when asked about it, did not deny that that was what's happening. So just another complication in this awful, awful situation.
David, let me turn to you. We've been dancing around this deadline, August the 31st, just 4 days from today. What is your sense of the reasonableness of that? The White House quick to emphasize that after this attack yesterday, they continued to run flights out of that airport in Kabul to get folks out of Kabul.
I think it's pretty revealing if you look at some of the comments from allies who've already stopped running evacuation flights. You saw the French government explicitly saying that they would like to see that deadline extended. They still had people they wanted to get out. You saw the British government, a bunch of other Europeans, NATO members, talking about whether there was some way of extending that. But I think coming to the realization that this is as much as anything else about American domestic politics, and that deadline is a hard one. And I think sitting here in Beijing, looking at the conversations of Central Asia, looking at some of the things the Chinese are saying, the Pakistanis, I think there's a sense of sort of, I don't know if it's sort of disbelief or dismay that the entire debate in places like America is about how America leaves over the next 4 days and whether the evacuation is going well, whether there's been incompetence, because they're now focused on what next. And, you know, in some ways, the clip you played at the beginning of President Biden saying that America was going to go after ISK, even that doesn't make a lot of sense from this part of the world, because he has very little leverage over a group that is willing to use suicide bombers. They're not actually that intimidated by an America that's leaving. So the focus on this side of the world is what next? Where is a stable Afghanistan going to come from? What kind of leverage do people have on the Taliban? And I think there's an impatience maybe at this focus in America on the next 3 or 4 days.
Laura, I want to turn to you quickly and just ask about what the Pentagon is expecting going forward here. There was talk of subsequent attacks, and you've had administration officials, national security officials saying they are prepared for more attacks, the likes of which we saw yesterday. How are they preparing for them? What are they saying about what they expect?
So it certainly seems like the Pentagon and intelligence officials are expecting more attacks, or at least attempts at attacks. We keep hearing about more and more specific and credible threats from ISIS-K particularly. My understanding is that obviously no other explosions have happened, no other attacks have taken place, but certainly everyone else is really on guard. And right now what they're doing is they are still relying on the Taliban for security at the outer perimeter. They are still evacuating personnel. And actually, in the last 24-hour period, they successfully evacuated 12,500 people outside of the Kabul airport. And that is pretty impressive, given the fact that there was a terrorist attack yesterday. And what General McKenzie said to the Pentagon press corps yesterday is that they have received threats to the aircraft that are taking off, but what they're doing is they are using ISR, which is their intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets, so planes flying around, eyes on the ground, that kind of thing, to watch the ground, watch the air, watch out in particular for threats from the ground and from the air from ISIS-K. And these planes, the military planes, of course, some of them have countermeasures. The commercial planes do not. But certainly, we have many eyes on the aircraft, many eyes from the airport. And it's very clear that what's happening inside the airport and what is happening with the planes taking off is pretty protected. What they're still worried about, of course, is something else that happens like yesterday, suicide bomb detonating around the perimeter of the airport, because, of course, the crowds are still there. And although they are lessening, it's still a pretty chaotic situation. So it's really going to be difficult to conduct counterterrorism in this situation.
David Rennie, let's tackle your what next question you raised a few minutes ago, how other countries are looking at what happens in Afghanistan well beyond this August 31st deadline. And I'll take advantage of you being in Beijing to ask you about China's approach to this new government in that country. And I guess to look forward, we have to look back. And I go back to a meeting that was held in late July in northern China. The foreign minister of China invited the co-founder of the Taliban to come for a series of meetings there, again, at the end of last month. I wonder what you made of that meeting at the time. Of course, hindsight is 2020, and what Chinese leadership has said about how it plans to recognize or approach this Taliban government in Afghanistan.
You're absolutely right. It was an extraordinary scene because we had the kind of the classic photo call with Wang Yi, the foreign minister, standing with a bunch of Taliban beside him as if they were kind of visiting Swiss dignitaries or something. And this was the culmination of actually years of increasingly close contacts between China and the Taliban. And it's not that they trust each other. It's not that they like each other. And of course, in many ways, China is extremely ferocious against any sign of Islamic radicalism inside China's borders, particularly in Xinjiang. So they have no ideological alignment either. But the Taliban are desperate for international recognition. They are desperate for investment. And China is their largest and richest neighbor. So they had something they wanted from China. And China's overwhelming interest in the long term is a stable Afghanistan that is secure and does not allow radical Islamists to cross into places like Xinjiang. They don't have a particular interest in Afghanistan being a very nice place. They're not that fussed about human rights. And I think what's really shocking, I think, at the moment is to see how openly the Chinese are saying they're sort of gloating that not only is America leaving because America has lost and the Taliban have won, which is, you know, an obvious thing for them to say, but they're drawing an ideological lesson, too. They're saying this shows that any foreign policy based on human rights or values is a complete disaster, and that this is America and the West's failure because they're so obsessed with human rights and democracy that they try and impose these models on foreign countries. So much better to be like China, all about interests, all about economics, nothing else. And we are morally superior to the disastrous catastrophe that you see America unleashing. So for the moment, China is delighted to have this chance to gloat in the face of America. In the long term, though, they are extremely keen to see an inclusive Afghan government. And they'll be very anxious about these signs of Islamic State. That any potential for a civil war and violence in Afghanistan would clearly be extremely troubling, not just to China, but all the countries around. And the final piece that is, again, speaks to the real difficulty that President Biden has in terms of leverage. Islamic State, K, also has links with the Pakistanis. It's probably funded by some Gulf Arab donors. So this is an absolute kind of maelstrom, again, tricky for China because China's big ally in the region is Pakistan. But I think they're looking for the best, sort of a pragmatic Taliban government that wants money and recognition and will do as it's told and not allow the border to be a source of Islamists. That's basically China's view.
Jen Williams, you heard there David Rennie describing that Chinese pragmatism. How have other countries around the world approached this, that being the recognition of this new government in Kabul? I know that in the U.S., I don't think that the administration has addressed it directly. It seems like there's very much a wait-and-see approach to sort of what happens next. And obviously, there's stuff to get through before August the 31st. But what have we heard from other countries, and how is their approach to this likely to play out?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to the Europeans in particular, they are very much taking the same kind of tact as as the United States in that terms of that wait-and-see approach that you said, you know, very much saying, you know, we're not really going to say whether we will recognize them or not. We were waiting to see how they handle human rights. You know, how do they behave? Who are they as a governing body 20 years on from when they used to govern Afghanistan? You know, it's still a very big question mark, I think, including for the people of Afghanistan, right? And I think the other big, you know, one of the big important regional players that we haven't talked about yet is Iran and how Iran is dealing with this. You know, Iran and the Taliban have had a very contentious relationship historically. I mean, you know, including almost coming to outright war at one point because of a Taliban attack. And so, you know, watching that kind of relationship unfold in the last couple of weeks has been really fascinating because the Taliban is very much making a concerted diplomatic effort to woo Iran and to try to kind of build ties with Iran and, you know, kind of heal some of those previous rifts that were between them because Iran is an important player very much, you know, more so than it was 20 years ago, even given, you know, everything that has unfolded with Iraq and everything like that. And so, you know, last year, even the Taliban, you know, appointed a Shia cleric from the Hazara community in order to kind of, you know, show, look, we are different. If you remember, you know, the Taliban, when they ruled back in the 90s and you know, during their rise, were essentially launched what amounts to a genocidal campaign against, you know, the Shia Hazara community. And Iran is a Shia Muslim power. And so, you know, there are very serious religious and ideological differences there that have kind of drawn that line between the two. And yet, the Taliban understands that if they want to have, you know, continued power in Afghanistan, if they want to be able to actually govern, they need Iran on side. They need to not have a big enemy in Tehran. And so they are trying to kind of make this diplomatic push to say, look, we can work with you. We're not, you know, these kind of extremists that you think you know from 20 years ago. We can be a responsible player. We can be a responsible partner, and really trying to kind of make that push in much the same way that they are doing with China and many other countries, right? They're trying to show the world that, look, we are something different. The big question is whether they are, right? And what that actually means. Is this all just PR, or is it actually real? And I don't think anyone has the answer yet.
Yeah, assessing the evolution so much as there has been one of the Taliban. And David Rennie, Jen talking about the sort of need for national security support from other countries. You were talking about the self-interest of the Chinese approach going forward. I imagine a lot of this has to do with economic considerations as well. The Afghan economy has been in free fall. There's now a freeze on getting money out of the country or into the country. Money transfers are now quite difficult, if not impossible. Foreign aid, very much an open question right now. How much of that is going to continue? In all likelihood, not very much of it will. Help us understand, David, just the economic considerations here at play, again, as this government tries to get up and running.
So there's short-term and long-term considerations. So you laid out the short-term ones that, you know, that the country hasn't had a government recognized by the outside world since the 15th of August. And so, you know, a whole bunch of things just can't happen. Lots of international money transfer systems are not willing to send money in because they might get full foul of sanctions. The IMF was due to make tens of millions of dollars available to Afghanistan. That can't happen as long as there isn't an officially recognized government. The Afghan Central Bank has $9 billion in reserves, but almost none of that is in Afghanistan. A lot of it's actually in America. So this question of recognition for the Taliban is incredibly important, because until they have something that looks like a functioning sort of economy and a government, then a whole bunch of international aid that has been the absolute pillar of the Afghan economy until now can't happen. Then, unfortunately, you get into a longer-term question. Can the Taliban graduate from their previous economic model, which was basically to be a kind of narco state? A huge amount of their revenues came from growing opium, taxing, smuggling of opium across their borders, essentially kind of working as a kind of criminal enterprise that controlled swathes of Afghan territory. And you're going to see a lot of their neighbors in Central Asia, the Russians, the Chinese, just as they're worrying about keeping the borders sealed, things like Islamists, they're also very concerned that this is going to turn into a kind of narco state, a failed state. Having said that, there have been some quite sort of excitable pieces talking about, you know, $1 trillion worth of minerals, copper and lithium and all sorts of things in the ground in Afghanistan, and how China is going to roll in and make a fortune there. I would be patient on that one, because China has actually been trying to set up things like a big copper mine for over a decade. It hasn't happened because Afghanistan is just not in a fit state to have something like a very elaborate copper mine. And the Chinese are extremely concerned about the security of their own people, even things like pipelines across Afghanistan. They've actually built a lot of stuff around Afghanistan. It would cost quite a lot of money to put it through Afghanistan. So it may be that something kind of poor and miserable but stable is a likelier scenario if you're sitting in Beijing than a kind of bonanza for a new Afghanistan.
We have a tweet here from Jerry Ann, quote, "I'm with Biden in continuing evacuations, but isn't his vow of retribution how we got tangled up in Afghanistan 20 years ago?" And Laura, I'll turn to you, drawing from that, with the question of what does retribution mean to this administration? And as the administration tries to plot its course forward, how much concern is there about how quickly and for how long they could be dragged into another conflict?
Well, certainly, I think we have seen the Biden administration take retribution, take action against attacks that have happened previously. Early on in the administration, the president authorized I believe there was two airstrikes separately against Iranian Shia militias in Iraq and Syria for attacking U.S. troops in both of those countries. So we know that the Biden administration will live up to its word and take action when it deems necessary. So I do believe we will definitely see the administration take action against ISIS-K. The question really is, how are they going to do that? Where and when? The question of how is a really interesting one because we have so few forces left in Afghanistan, and we are about to have even fewer when we draw down to zero by August 31st, which I believe is next Tuesday. Now, the Pentagon has said they are maintaining what they call an over-the-horizon capability, which means they are basing aircraft and other assets on aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf, out of air bases in Qatar and the UAE and other places in the Middle East, which will then make that long flight to Afghanistan to do their work. But the problem there is that is a really, really long flight. It's a 9-hour flight by tanker. And of course they need to refuel. And of course the armed Reaper drones that they're sending can't always take the journey with a lot of ordnance on it. So there's a real question of how long we're going to be able to keep this counterterrorism capability. Now, of course, there have also been discussions of potentially basing some troops, some covert operational troops in nearby Uzbekistan or Tajikistan, which would be a shorter flight. And certainly there may still be special forces or CIA presence on the ground somewhere unofficially. But right now, we just don't know quite yet. And frankly, I don't think the Pentagon knows quite yet either.
Jen Williams, on that, the threat of ISIS-K, anything that you want to add just about how the Pentagon, how the president's national security team is looking at the sustained or growing threat of that group in this new Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think there's something really important to understand here. And that's, you know, what Laura said is that U.S. forces are supposed to be down to zero by August 31st, right? And that means that, well, when it comes to the threat of, you know, who exactly ISIS-K is going to attack, Americans are not going to be in Afghanistan, right? American forces are not going to be there. And so there's a big question that beyond just an immediate retaliatory strike, what actually is the long-term threat from ISIS-K? And is there actually a long-term threat to America, to the American homeland in particular, right? And, you know, does that require a sustained, you know, military campaign or counterterrorism campaign? You know, ISIS-K is very much, you know, has been around for quite a while now, for, you know, at least 5-6 years now since 2015. And they have mostly attacked Afghan security forces and the Taliban and, you know, thousands of civilians as well. But the question is, you know, whether they actually pose a threat to the U.S. versus U.S. interests. And that also requires us to kind of redefine what is the U.S. interest in Afghanistan anymore going forward, right? Now, if we still see the Taliban as our enemies and we don't want them to have control of Afghanistan, well, in some ways, them having to fight off ISIS-K is potentially beneficial in terms of a long-term kind of strategy of weakening the Taliban. Now, that doesn't mean that that's not going to cause, you know, thousands of casualties, and that's awful. But in terms of, you know, what we're talking about, in terms of the U.S. interest going forward in the country, you have to understand that these kind of local affiliate groups may, in many cases, adopt the kind of broader anti-American kind of global rhetoric of groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. However, they are often mostly focused on their own local aims and their own kind of local project. And that means that once the U.S. is out, there are, you know, fewer targets, but there's also less reason to try to attack. And then there's the question of, you know, inspiring attacks in the homeland, and they can do that from anywhere. You know, they do it online. And so really looking at what is the threat long term, and is there really a threat that would require a sustained military counterterrorism campaign? And I'm not sure that's the case.
Well, the hunt for the origin of COVID-19 continues. This week, President Biden received a report he ordered back in May about the coronavirus. It was classified. But what we do know is it was inconclusive. David Runney, let me turn to you. This has become something of an object that's been volleyed back and forth between Beijing and Washington, the two sides fighting about access to information related to COVID-19 and just fighting about the origin of the virus itself. What's the latest from where you sit? What are the Chinese saying about this report that the president ordered 90 days ago?
So even before this inconclusive report was delivered to his desk, you saw the Chinese with this kind of all-out propaganda assault. It's been going on for weeks, but it's moved from kind of tabloid newspapers belonging to the Communist Party to the podium of the Chinese Foreign Ministry. Day after day, we have had the spokesman for the Foreign Ministry saying that maybe the virus began in an American military laboratory in Fort Detrick in Maryland. Why are the Americans not allowing an international probe of that? There is absolutely no evidence of this. It began as an internet conspiracy theory about a year ago, and China has now embraced it. They're talking about a scientist at the University of North Carolina who was working on coronaviruses. Maybe they should investigate him. And in the meantime, it's not just America. It's, in fact, the World Health Organization, many other countries with advanced kind of public health systems, extremely frustrated with the Chinese government that has been basically throwing up as much dust and confusion as they can to try and end and shut down any discussion of whether this virus began in China. And that's not just a political point, although here in China they keep saying this is just an American political attack. It is scientifically incredibly important to prevent the next pandemic, to know how this one began. Was it a lab leak? Was it a transfer from mammals being sold in a food market to human beings, the kind of classic zoonotic route that we've seen with previous pandemics like SARS? We need to know how this began. The truth is that we will probably never know, because it began somehow in China, and China has absolutely no interest in having that conversation, because it wants to talk about how its extremely strict quarantine and contact tracing here in China has basically crushed the virus, whereas America and other Western countries are still full of cases, full of death and destruction and chaos. And this proves that the Chinese system is superior in every way to decadent, failed, selfish, individualistic Western America. And so the science is being completely trampled. And that's a tragedy because it's going to lead to the next pandemic not being prevented as it should be.
Jen Williams, what was the goal of commissioning this report? Again, we're operating from reporting that we've seen on the classified version of it. A more public-facing one is expected to come out in the coming days, according to the White House. What did President Biden want this report to convey or to investigate? And what do we know of the substance of it at this point?
Well, much of it was about domestic politics, to be perfectly honest. You know, especially from the right, from some members of the GOP, there was a lot of accusations against Biden for not doing more to investigate the origins of this, to not do more to push China in particular, to turn over evidence and to cooperate, not doing more to punish China if they were responsible, et cetera. And so a lot of this was to kind of quiet down some of that domestic criticism and saying, look, I'm gonna take action. You know, I am the president. I am going to take action. I'm going to assign my intelligence officials to, you know, do this really big, deep dive. The problem is that that doesn't mean that they're going to have any more information than they had before those 90 days were up, right? I think the intelligence community is already pretty clearly focused on trying to figure this out, and they hadn't yet. And so, you know, a lot of the problem is going to be that we don't have a lot of the original information, because a lot of it was likely, you know, destroyed or pushed aside and, you know, tucked away to never see the light of day for a very long time. And I think there's a good chance that we probably won't know a definitive answer for the foreseeable future. And I think that's really important to understand. You know, I think David's absolutely right in talking about how important it is that we do understand the origins of this. And yet, my former Vox colleague, Umer Irfan, has a really great piece on Vox talking about how, you know, kind of regardless of whether it did come from a lab or it came from animals, we kind of don't need to know the answer to start, you know, taking actions to prevent the next pandemic from happening. We should just assume that both are likely, right? We can assume that it was a lab, or we can assume that it came from animals. We can take steps to stop both of those things from happening. Because if both of those things are equally plausible, or to some degree, you know, both are plausible, well, that means that, you know, that could happen again from either one of those sources. And so taking action now to mitigate and saying, okay, well, we don't know if it was this or that, but why don't we take steps to mitigate, you know, either one from ever happening again? And that's something that we can do, and we don't actually need to have the definitive answer yet. Yes, it would be really helpful to have more specific data to be able to focus, you know, our efforts on one or the other. But again, you know, this isn't the first pandemic that has happened from, you know, animal transmission. And so, you know, continuing to focus on that, on wet markets, et cetera, on ways of transmission would be helpful. And it would also be helpful, again, regardless of whether, you know, this specific pandemic started from a lab, to be more careful and to take steps to secure, you know, better secure research facilities. You know, high level research facilities are already very secure, but taking a look, figuring out ways where we can make that more secure to make sure that even if this one didn't come from a lab leak, that another one doesn't come. And so, you know, again, I think this report tells us basically what we already knew, which is we don't know, and we're not going to probably know for a while. And you know, that's not great, but it doesn't mean that we can't start taking action now to prevent another pandemic from happening.
David Rennie, I'm curious how China is navigating the Delta variant. I gather it's among a handful of countries that are kind of pioneering or trying to get to a zero COVID approach. You've seen that in New Zealand as well. I know that there have been penalties announced for those who refuse vaccination in the country and in several cities. How virulent is the virus right now in Beijing, where you are, and elsewhere through the country? And how has the government's response to it changed as we've seen the emergence of this new variant?
So this is something that every time I've been on this show, since, you know, I've not left China in whatever it is, 20 months now. I've been here throughout the entire pandemic, and I have tried to explain sort of every time just how different China's approach is. Mm-hmm. This giant country locked its borders shut in March 2020 and has basically kept them pretty much tightly shut. And they have extraordinary kind of lockdowns, rules on masks now, as you say, intense pressure on people to get vaccinated. If you want to send your kids to school, they must be vaccinated here in Beijing. There are now towns and cities saying that if you're not vaccinated and you cause an outbreak, then you'll be civilly liable. I've had colleagues refuse access to get into a railway station because they didn't have the vaccine. But just day to day here, you know, you are tracked a dozen times a day. You have to scan a QR code with your smartphone, which tracks your movements. You are asked to show a screen which tracks using your phone's movements the last 2 weeks where you've been. If you've been anywhere near within sort of 100 miles of somewhere that had a case, a single case, then they can refuse you access to Beijing, refuse to allow you get on a plane. As a result, although I know some listeners may not believe this, there is not an outbreak of COVID here in China. And we know that because every time there's a tiny outbreak, they lock down an entire city of millions of people for kind of a dozen cases. And so if there were giant outbreaks out there, we would know about it because it always leaked in the past during this entire pandemic. So this country of 1.4 billion people currently has, you know, cases like a double-digit new cases a day, as opposed to the US, which is running at 150,000 new cases a day. And seen from China, I have to tell you, that is a catastrophe for the image of the West. Ordinary Chinese who previously thought quite highly of the States, they look at their images of people refusing to wear masks in the States, refusing to take vaccines, and they think that America is a failed state, a broken society. And the PR hit that the West has taken during this pandemic is unbelievably serious.
Australia is in the neighborhood. I wouldn't call it a neighbor of China, but I imagine that that's a country that the Chinese government is watching very closely, as we've seen rates in that part of the Pacific really tick up as well.
That's right. And so we had a press conference by the World Health Organization's regional office in the Western Pacific, and it shows exactly that the Delta variant, just because it is so easily transmitted, is a challenge to all of these countries that are trying this so-called zero COVID approach. And so New Zealand, which is another one of these, had 225 new cases, having had zero cases for a long time. Australia had 5,600 new cases between the 18th and the 24th of August. That's nearly 6,000 cases. They had 17 deaths. So you see, Delta is just an extraordinary challenge. The Chinese response is to lock this entire giant country down even more tightly. And there's now a real debate as to whether a country this size can keep that going with a variant like Delta out there. But heartbreakingly, in the rest of Asia, you're seeing the Delta variant is just so contagious that you're seeing giant numbers. You know, Japan in a week put on 160,000 cases, the Philippines, Malaysia, they were in real trouble because Asia hadn't been as bad. And the other heartbreaking thing is we have pretty good numbers in Asia because a lot of these governments like Japan, they're pretty good at testing. We don't even know what's happening in a continent like Africa because so many African governments don't have the public health systems or the capacity to test. And so it may be that the numbers are even more out of control in the continent of Africa, where a tiny percentage have been vaccinated, and we don't even know.
I want to turn our attention to Israel here in the remaining moments that we have. We are seeing one of the highest daily infection rates in the world in that country. As of last week, nearly one in every 150 people in Israel had the virus. Israel's COVID czar appeared before parliament this week and said, quote, "I don't want to frighten you, but unfortunately, the numbers don't lie. Jen, get us up to speed on what's happened in Israel. This is a country that was held up as an exemplar at the beginning of this pandemic, that was able to obtain enough injections, immunizations for the entire population of that country. It immunized very early. What's changed in that country in recent weeks?
The short answer is the Delta variant is what has changed, and the fact that they did vaccinate very early. And the reason that we are now having a conversation about booster shots here in the U.S. is because Israel has rolled out booster shots. And the evidence for that is coming largely from Israel. And the fact that they vaccinated very early on, we are now coming to see that the effects of the vaccine, the protection from the vaccine, does seem to start to wane over time. Now, the protection, I think it's really important to say, the protection against serious illness and death still seems to be very robust over time from the vaccines. But in terms of contracting the virus and in terms of passing on the virus, it seems that the effects of the vaccine, specifically the Pfizer vaccine is the one that was used primarily in Israel, seems to wane. And so that's why they launched at the end of July a campaign to give booster shots to over 60, to the people who are over 60 years of age. They have since lowered that to now people who are over age 40, and then likely expected that it will kind of continue to broaden to more and more people. And so we are seeing already the impact of that booster shot campaign. The numbers are starting to slow. They are starting to come back down. It does seem like they are starting to get it back under control. But I think the problem that we're seeing is, you know, a problem that we've seen around the world, which is the Delta variant is much more transmissible. And we all kind of thought that because of the way that the original COVID variant kind of operated, that we would be okay taking off our masks if we were fully vaccinated. It turns out that's probably not the case, that we can still get it. If you are vaccinated, you can potentially still get it. It may not make you severely ill to the point that you need to be, you know, on a ventilator in the ICU. You could still get, you know, pretty sick. You could be, you know, in bed for a week with a pretty nasty case of what feels like a really bad flu. And you can still transmit it. And so that is the problem here with Israelis. Many stopped wearing masks, started kind of reopening, you know, the economy, kind of like many of us did, right? Started going back out and living life again. And people are now starting to the Delta variant is just a different beast altogether. And so that's why we are seeing this big campaign of returning to mask wearing. There are already conversations about potentially needing to do another round of some sort of lockdown in Israel. There's obviously pushback against that because we've all seen the economic impacts of lockdowns around the world. And so I think, you know, Israel has been kind of at the forefront of many things, as you said, at the forefront of getting most of its population vaccinated. And it's now at the forefront of seeing what the booster shots are going to do to bring those numbers back down.
You know, I have heard comments from people who are holding up what's happening in Israel now as evidence that perhaps the vaccines aren't as effective as we thought they would be. And I wonder how the Israeli government is pushing back against that. You're mentioning the fact that there is this push now for boosters, for more immunizations. Is that a problem, that kind of misinformation or dubious information, a problem in Israel as it is here in the United States?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think public health messaging and the challenges of communicating really complex, nuanced scientific health information to the general public is a really big challenge, as we've seen since this pandemic. We've all become experts in public health messaging, right? It's a very, you know, hard kind of line to walk by saying you are still mostly protected from very severe illness and death, and yet also having to say, but, you know, immunity is waning from the vaccines. That's confusing, right? Just on its face, that's, well, wait, what do you mean? How come it's still working and it's not working? And how does that mean the same thing? And I think, you know, there's a lot of confusion too. What a public health official means by severe illness is not necessarily what I would mean by severe illness, right? When they say, when public health officials say you're protected against severe illness, they mean literally being on a ventilator, needing oxygen in the ICU, in the hospital, you know, on death's door. What I think about a severe illness is I feel like crap and I don't, you know, I can't get out of bed for a week or 2 weeks. And so when they're saying, no, you won't get severe illness, and there are all these people going, well, I feel like I have a pretty severe illness right now. That's also, you know, causing some of this confusion and lack of trust in the public health community, you know, they're providing the same accurate information. It's hard to kind of parse that for the general public. And so we're seeing that same challenge in Israel as we are everywhere else.
So let's bring it full circle and talk about how the story of what's unfolding in Afghanistan is shaping foreign policy around the world. The new prime minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, is in Washington. He was scheduled to meet with President Biden yesterday in the Oval Office, on Thursday in the Oval Office. That meeting was moved to today, happening Friday. Talk, if you could, briefly just about what disagreement exists there, principally with regard to the Iran nuclear deal, something that the president has said wants to get back into, of course, this new prime minister against them.
So this very right-wing prime minister, who nonetheless leads a very broad coalition, he has sent a message that he wants to be less confrontational than his predecessor, Bibi Netanyahu, was on the Iran deal. But he is no fan of the Iran deal. And you've seen the chief of the Israeli general staff talking about how they are capable of taking military action against Iran, that they need a kind of bigger deal that takes in Iran's missile capabilities, Iran's making of mischief around the whole Middle East. So although the tone could not be more different from that confrontational relationship that Netanyahu had with President Obama, the actual message is still one of total distrust for this deal and a warning that Israel may take action on its own if it doesn't feel that something is going to be done about Iran's nukes.
David Rennie, thank you very much. David Rennie with The Economist, Jen Williams, soon to be the deputy editor at Foreign Policy. Thank you all for joining us as well. Our senior producer is Jonklin Hill, and our managing producer is Paige Osborne. Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. The program comes to you from WAMU, which is part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm David Gurek.